I think we begin at November 16, 1906. Is that right? Okay. The difference between the offences of the religious and those of the secular, meaning the laity. But the term secular for Louisa doesn't just include the laity as we know it, meaning members of the church, but everybody out there who's not actually part of the church. So all the unbelievers and everything. The term secular is used in a different sense nowadays because it literally means without God. Okay. Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, I saw the many offences committed by priests and by religious people and the great sorrow that Blessed Jesus felt because of them. Almost surprised, I said, my sweet life, it's true that religious people offend you, but it seems to me that the laity or the secular offend you more. Yet, you know, you show greater sorrow for the first than the second. It seems you're all eyes to look at what the first are doing and you seem not to look at what the second are doing. Now, before we even move on, the people who hurt you the most are not the ones living on the next street. They're the ones who are living in your house. And the reason is they are the ones who are closest to you. They're the ones who are committed to you. Okay. And that's the logic of what Jesus is saying. And he said, ah, my daughter, you cannot understand the difference that exists between the offences of the religious and those of the laity. That is why you are surprised. The religious have declared that they belong to me. That means they've taken vows. Okay, that they love me and that they serve me. And I have entrusted the treasures of my grace to them. So they're in charge of the church and its mission. And I've given them the treasures of the, I've given the treasures of the sacraments to others who are the priests. Now, while pretending on the outside, what is that? What is the word for that? Hypocrisy. It's the one thing Jesus really, really condemned. While pretending on the outside that they belong to me, in their interior, if they need, they are far from me. Now, that's literally Matthew 15, verses 1 to 10. Matthew 15, verses 1 to 10. This people honour me with lip service, but their hearts are far from me. Also, Psalm 5, verses 5 to 6. Psalm 5, verses 5 to 6. They show that they love me and serve me, but they offend me and they use holy things to serve their own passions. Now, that is a very specific insult to the Lord. Beside that, I want you to put Habakkuk 1:13. H-A-B-B is Habakkuk. Habakkuk 1:13. Lord, your eyes are too holy to look upon sin, is what that says. This is why I am all eyes, so as not to let them spoil my gifts and my graces. But in spite of my cares, they reach the point of wreaking havoc with those very things with which on the outside they seem to be glorifying me. That was precisely the problem that Jesus had with the scribes and Pharisees. This offence is so grave that if you could understand it, you would die of heartbreak. On the other hand, the secular or the laity declare that they don't belong to me and they don't know me. Now, very particularly those who are outside the church and that they don't want to serve me. And because of this, first of all, they are free of the spirit of hypocrisy, which is what the problem of the others, which is the thing that displeases me the most. So put beside that Matthew 23, where Jesus gave a terrible indictment to the scribes and Pharisees because of hypocrisy. Therefore, since they have declared themselves, I have not been able to entrust my gifts to them, even though grace excites them, it fights them, it has not given itself because they don't want it. It happens, we would say, it's the same as if a king who, having waged battle to free the people from the slavery in which they were kept by other kings, they managed by force of blood to free some of those people. And then he placed them under his dominion, providing everything for them and, if necessary, letting them live in his own residence. That's the position of the priests and religious. Now, who would displease him more if they offended him? The peoples which have remained far away from him and which he yet wanted to free are the ones that actually live with him. That's the problem of the elder brother in Luke 15. So if you put Luke 15, because the elder brother was actually still staying in the father's house. And yet he sinned greatly against the father. And yet you would get the impression from the story that the real sinner was the younger one. When the story is finished, you're not so sure about that, are you? Okay. So November the 18th, 1906. And the heading is very important. The works without interior spirit and upright intention bloat the soul, doesn't make it grow. Now, bloating isn't a wonderful feeling, as you know. As I was in my usual state, I saw only a shadow of blessed Jesus, and he told me, "My daughter, if a food could be separated from his substance and someone else ate it, it would be of no use. Or rather, it would serve only to bloat his stomach. In other words, you get no value out of it. Such are the works without interior spirit and without upright intention, being emptied of divine substance. They are of no use and they serve only to bloat the person." Now, in spiritual language, that is pride. They serve only to make you proud. Therefore, he receives more harm than good. Therefore, things are not what they seem, is what you're being told, aren't you? No. Things are not what they seem. So a person can have the right clothes, they can have the right job, they can be in the right place, they can be doing the right actions, and they may not be serving God at all. And somebody else who doesn't appear to be serving God at all might be loving and kind and forgiving. It's amazing. So November the 20th, 1906. Obedience communicates divine strength to the soul. Now, you underline divine. "My poor state continues," Louisa says, "full of bitterness because of the almost continuous privations that I suffer, but also of peace." That's very important that she adds that. She has all this pain, but she has this peace in her soul. You see, without that peace, you're not really in the divine will. The peace that passes all understanding is Philippians 4, 8. Philippians 4, 7, sorry. Philippians 4, 7. "I saw him just flashing by, telling me, 'My daughter, obedience is an unshakable wall, and such it renders the soul.'" That's Psalm 18, verses 2 and 31. Not only strong and robust, and obedience communicates divine strength in such a way that in the face of the divine strength that it possesses, all things are weak. So I want to give you Psalm 27, verse 5. Psalm 27, verse 5, and Psalm 62, verse 2. "So much so that while obedience can move everything, nothing can move it." Now you can see why Jesus has absolutely insisted that Louisa's entire life be based on obedience, because he is doing such an incredible work in her that if she wasn't on this absolutely solid foundation, she could easily go astray. And the whole church will be depending on this revelation as the revelation breaks out further and further into the church. So November the 28th, 1906, I have a VIP on it. And it's about Jesus returning to the earth to live in and through souls in the divine will. So it's an explanation of how the return of Jesus to the earth is going to come. Now, there are the evangelicals and people like that are absolutely certain he's going to come back in the flesh. He's going to live in an actual city called the New Jerusalem, and it is going to fall down out of heaven by some unknown means. and that Jesus is going to actually reign on the earth for 1,000 years, all physical. Okay. And even though they claim that they understand the scriptures better than Catholics, because they take such a fundamentalist approach to it, they actually distort it. And one of the most basic things that you will come across in scripture is God never repeats himself. He's a creator. And that's number one. And number two, not only does he never repeat himself, the only thing he enjoys doing is creating, apart from loving. So if you can create and you get an opportunity to create, would you patch? No. Did Jesus say he would patch? He said, no, no way would he put a patch on a cloth. The cloth was Judaism. He said, no way. No way would I put new wine into old wineskins. He does something completely new. But the second thing that the scriptures make perfectly clear is that he manages to fulfill all his promises and still surprise everybody in the way he does it. Now, only the few people who are in the divine will know the way he's coming back. All the others are writing books about it. They're all wrong. And if they knew what we knew about the return of Christ, they wouldn't believe us at all, that he would return in simple, ordinary people. Do you know what I mean? But if they examined the gospel, they would realize he always went to the poor, the lame, the blind, the lepers, the marginalized, the people that other people thought weren't important.
And the sinners.
Well, they're all sinners. But he always went to the people that nobody thought you should give any attention to. So he's come to us as well. I think it's brilliant. Yeah. But it's only the humble are going to get it. And the Psalms say that only the humble will hear and be glad. So this is a very important message. Continuing in my poor state, I just barely saw blessed Jesus, who seemed to transform all of himself into me. See how deep the divine will goes. You in me and I in you. That's John 14, 21. John 14, 21. If I moved one arm, I could feel him move his arm within me. So what she's trying to illustrate here is that this is a genuine reality. This isn't some mystical grace that you have to imagine in your mind, okay? And so with all the rest, if she moved a foot, she could feel his. While he was doing this, he told me, my beloved daughter, you need to know the language that we use for this, and that is he bilocates himself in us. Okay, just to make sure you write it down, he bilocates himself in us. And she doesn't know a big word called bilocation. Okay, so she describes the thing that it's real. So he said, my beloved daughter, see in what close union I am with you. This is how I want you to be, completely united and clasped to me. We would say two metals soldered together. Okay. And do not think that you must do this only when you suffer or pray, but rather always, always. If you move, if you breathe, if you work, if you eat, if you sleep, everything, everything as if you were doing it in my humanity and as if your working came from me in such a way that you should be nothing but the cortex. And once the cortex of your work is broken, one would find the fruit of the divine work. So there you have the cortex of the tree and all the life is inside. Okay, and all the work that that tree is doing is on the inside. You can use it, but don't keep.
Put it on that.
You can use it, but that's just making noise on that. Okay, so you have the cortex of the tree, and then you have all the activity of the tree is inside, and all the fruitfulness then appears in the external parts of it. So the outer layer is Louisa, and the inner activity is the divine will. You have a very good description there of a living host, haven't you? Just want to give you the crossover. A living host. The accidents are on the outside and the divine presence is on the inside, okay, as the source of life. So everything is to be done for the Lord. So beside that, I want you to do Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus. Okay. So everything, you're to do it as if you were doing it in my humanity and as if your working came from me in such a way that you would be nothing but the cortex. And once the cortex of your work is broken in death, that's understood, you would find the fruit of a divine work. This is the revelation of the divine will operating and living in us. And this you must do for the good of the whole of humanity. That's one of the signs of a person in the divine will. They are concerned with all souls, past, present and future, not just with one or two. In such a way that my humanity must be present as though alive in the midst of people. So you can see that this is his way to be present and active in the midst of the society around. So this is like another incarnation, and just put the word incarnation in inverted commas, because incarnation means in a body. Is that okay? And this is his way to come back and live with us. In fact, as you do everything, even the most indifferent actions with this intention of receiving life from me, your action acquires the merit of my humanity. Look at that. Because it's Jesus acting, living and acting in us. So our actions then acquire the merits of his humanity. Because since I was man and God, in my breathing, I contained the breathing of all. In his movements, in his actions, in his thoughts, he contained the movements and actions and thoughts of everything within himself. Therefore, I sanctified them, I divinized them, I repaired them. So by doing everything in the act of receiving all of your working from me, you too will come to embrace and contain all creatures within you. Now, we're still at the stage of being very anxious to pray for individuals, okay? But he's telling you that if you actually understand operating in the divine will, you have them all inside of you, every one of them, past, present and future. Every one of them. You're praying for them all. But it's just hard for us to take it on board when we're so used to praying for individuals. So you too will come to embrace and contain all creatures within you. And your working will diffuse for the good of all. All is PPF, past, present and future. Therefore, even if the others will give me nothing, I will take everything from you. So our operating means that the glory and praise and thanksgiving and reparation that are required and are due to the Lord will actually be given to him on behalf of everyone. So Louisa said, I think I'm talking nonsense. She uses that expression to say, I'm not sure if I got through to you. These are intimate things and I am unable to say them well. I would like to write them as I have them in my mind, but I cannot. That's typical of someone who has received information in an out-of-the-body experience. When they come back into the body, they just don't have the words. It seems that I take one drop of light and 100 more escape me. It would have been better if I had kept silent, but after all, everything is for the glory of God. So, December the 3rd, 1906. The sweetness and the peace of the soul. Now, one of the things that Louisa points out very clearly in the Passion of Jesus is the sweetness that he showed to all the people that were torturing him. No matter how terrible they were treating him, he had this extraordinary, peaceful and sweet expression for them all, to the point where they had to blindfold him. They couldn't take looking at him. Since Blessed Jesus was not coming, I felt such bitterness, Louisa says. Not only this, but a sort of hitch within my interior, such as to make me almost restless, she said. What pain? All other pains compared to this are nothing but shadows, or rather refreshment. Your privation alone can be given the name of pain. Okay, so I've explained to you before that both purgatory and hell, the pain is the absence of God. And purgatory is not as bad as hell because someday you will have him. Okay. Now, while I was fidgeting, he came out in passing from within my interior and he said to me, "What is the matter with you? Calm yourself, calm yourself. Here I am, not only with you, but within you." Okay. And then, it's okay, use it. "I do not want this restless heart." Okay. So I want you to write Psalm 62, verses 1 to 2 and verses 5 to 8. "Rest in God, my soul. I know I feel like a tumbling wall and a tottering fence, but rest in God, my soul." Okay. "Everything in you must be sweetness and peace, in such a way that it may be said of you that which was said of me, that nothing but milk and honey flows from me." Now, there you have got an answer to a major question in the Old Testament. And the major question, someone's mobile phone is on. Can you turn it off? You can hear it. Will you turn off all mobile phones, please? The Old Testament question is, why was the land of Canaan called the land of milk and honey? Anybody who has ever been there knows that milk and honey don't flow around the place. Is it turned off?
It is.
Okay. So everybody's off, are they? Mm-hmm. Now you know that it's called the land of milk and honey because they were having this very special relationship with God. Okay. So it's a major answer to a question that theologians and scripture scholars have battled with all down the centuries. So you can say that you know the answer. Sorry. Turn it off. The left button, turn it off. Left button. So he said, "Nothing but milk and honey flows from me, symbolizing sweetness and honey, peace from milk." Okay. "I am so filled and soaked with them that they pour out from my eyes, from my mouth, and from all my works. And if you are not likewise, I feel dishonored by you, because while the one who is all peace and sweetness dwells within you, you do not honor me by showing even the slightest shadow of a resentful and restless heart." Okay, that's a very important statement, he says. In the divine will, we have this very special relationship with God. And it's to lead us to a new and divine holiness, not a human holiness, but a divine holiness. So he says, in us, if there's even a shadow of resentment, that is a huge, huge, huge thing. So I want to give you a few scriptures on that. 1 Samuel 2:30. And a very big one in Sirach, or Ecclesiasticus, S-I-R is Sirach, chapter 27, from verse 30 to chapter 28, verse 9. And in the book of Sirach, you're told that resentment is a foul thing and it is found with sinners. Hence, you're going to find there's no tolerance for it at all in divine will. Is that okay? Book of Sirach, chapter 27, from verse 30 to chapter 28, verse 9. Okay. So,
chapter 28, is it?
Verse 9. So he doesn't want either even a shadow of a resentful or a restless heart. Now, the restlessness thing, he has talked about it from volume 1 to 4 non-stop. He kept on saying to her, if you are restless, if you are not at peace within, then you can be attacked by temptations, by human beings, by demons, by everything, but you won't get through to God. God needs this peace inside of you, because this peace is a union with God in total trust. Okay? So he says very clearly, I love this sweetness and peace so much that even if it were about something great concerning my honour and glory, I do not want, I never approve resentful, violent, fiery manners. I don't know how many of us that knocks out, but, you know, it hits hard. But he has the very clear words, I do not want. That couldn't be clearer, could it? But I want rather sweet and peaceful manners. That's your Philippians 4:7, the peace that passes all understanding. Okay. In fact, sweetness alone is that which binds hearts like a chain in such a way that they cannot unbind themselves. Now, he's saying that this sweet, gentle manner draws people to God more than anything else. It is like pitch that sticks to them and they cannot free themselves, and they're forced to say, in this soul, there is the finger of God. Now, there's Jesus himself using the language of the magicians back in Exodus chapter 8, verse 19. This is the finger of God. And you also have a reference to that in Luke 11, 20. So Exodus 8, 19 and Luke 11, 20. And if you look at me for a moment, I'll illustrate it. The finger of God is always illustrated this way, that it's the forefinger of the right hand with the other fingers down and the thumb that way, and it's a sign of authority. And so when people in the Old Testament said that's the finger of God's right hand, obviously their emperors and Caesars and pharaohs and that used that as a sign of their authority. Okay? So that means that God is actually present with his authority. Okay. In this soul, there is the finger of God, and we cannot act otherwise. And then, if I do not like a resentful manner, not even creatures like it, which is actually true, isn't it? You see, we've been made like God, and the things we don't like in other people, God doesn't like in us either. Okay. If one speaks about or deals with things, even of God, with manners that are not sweet and peaceful, it's a sign that he does not have his passions in order. My goodness, what would he have said about when we were young and the Redemptorists were thumping the altar, shouting that God would send us to hell for even being late for Mass for 2 minutes? I don't know, what do you think of that? And they thought they were putting the fear of God in us. I don't think they succeeded, did they? It means that he does not have his passions in order. And one who does not keep himself in order cannot order others. You can only give what you have. Therefore, be careful with anything which is not sweetness and peace if you do not want to dishonor me. So I'm going to give you a few scriptures on that one, okay, to look it up. The book of Judges, chapter 14 and verse 14. Book of Judges 14:14. Psalm 119:103. Psalm 119:103. Philippians 4:18. And 2 Corinthians 2:15. So that's Judges 14:14, Philippians 4:18, 2 Corinthians 2:15, and Psalm 119, verse 103. So December the 6th, 1906. Jesus hides to see what the soul will do. This is a very, very simple incident, but it's actually more important than you think. Continuing in my state of almost total privation, at the most, he comes like a flash or a shadow. I was saying in my interior, life of my life, how is it that you're not coming? Oh, how cruel you have become to me. How hard your heart has become as you reach the point of not listening to me. Where are your promises? Where is your love since you leave me abandoned in the abyss of miseries? Yet you promised me that you would never leave me, Joshua 1:5. You told me that you love me. And now, she said, you yourself told me that it is from one's constancy that it can be known whether one really loves you. That's the reference to the very first thing in this volume. And if there is no constancy, one cannot rely on this love. So how is it that you want it from me, who does not form your life, and then you who are my life deny it to me? She doesn't let him off with much, does she?
No.
But who can say all of my nonsense, she said, I would be too long. In the meantime, he moved in my interior. He's there all the time. Raising his arm in the act of sustaining me, and he says, I am within you. Luke 17:21. And I hide more in you to see what you will do. I have failed in nothing, neither in promises, nor in love, nor in constancy. If you, imperfect, do it, I do it in the fullness of perfection towards you. Now, she doesn't go on with explaining this. She was probably too shocked. But the Lord is saying, sometimes your people say, well, I prayed and I did all the right things and I did my fasting and all the rest of it and he didn't answer me. I didn't get the result I wanted. And we do not take into account that the Lord wants your growth more than anything else. He wants you to grow in union with him more than anything else. And very often he does what is generally called the cliffhanger move. Have you heard of the cliffhanger move before?
Yeah.
The cliffhanger move is that he waits until you're hanging over the cliff and the next breath you're gone and you're dead. And he wants to see, will you trust him up to and including the last breath? And if you trust him beyond reason, because you've heard me tell you before that he has told me to tell everyone to trust him beyond reason. If you trust him beyond reason and you are hanging over the cliff onto a branch, I know this, I've been there, done that and got the T-shirt. And we say, Lord, when the branch goes, then there's only you left. Okay. Then he moves. Because what you've done is you've passed the test of trust. Let me illustrate it for you. And this is a story that I didn't make up. It's the story of a man who was able to ride a bicycle on a rope across the Niagara Falls. And he had a crowd. You've heard the story before. There was a crowd on either side. And of course, they gave him a huge roar of applause when he arrived on the other side. So he got off his bike and he said, so I can do it, can't I? And they said, yes. He said, someone get up on the back and come with me. And out of a crowd of thousands of people, not one offered to join him. Now, that's the way Jesus is. He says, you know, I can walk on water. You know that I've actually done it. How about following me? Because to me, walking on water means that you are walking in total trust. You're just trusting him. You're not looking at the circumstances around you. You're just saying, I'm keeping my eyes on you and that's it. I'm just trusting. And people will agree with it on paper and they'll clap anybody who does it. But let them step out and do it. It's a different matter. You know, you can put a mat down on this floor and say, would you walk on it? You say, of course I'll walk on it, no problem. But the same mat over a gorge with a 300-foot drop, will you walk on it? No way. It's a different matter altogether. Because the second time, there's no floor underneath. And so the first time is not a test. The second time is. So Jesus said to Louisa, I hold back to see what you will do. Now, we've seen a couple of times that she responded magnificently, I'll offer this up for everybody, and I'll at one stage, and I'll offer it up to prove my love for you. And here she's back complaining, her usual stunt. She's terribly like us, isn't she? That we do fine and we can really make it at one stage, and then we're right back to the old stuff again. And just one of the things I absolutely love about her. If she was less humble, she would have left out the bits that enables us to grow. Okay. So December the 15th, 1906, how the divine will contains all goods. And you need to sort of underline the all bit. Continuing in my usual state, I was feeling embittered more than ever because of his privation. In one moment, I felt as though absorbed in the will of God, and I felt all my interior appeased. Now, to have that, everything inside of her brought to this total calm, she had to be absorbed into the divine will in such a way as to no longer feel myself. Now, what she's talking about there is she's not feeling her body at all. She's not feeling anything inside of her body. I only feel the divine will in everything, even in his privation. Now, that's a major, major, major statement on Louise's part, a major step forward. This is going to be her reality as she goes on. I myself said to myself, what strength, what enchantment, what magnet the divine will contains, such as to make me forget all about myself and make the divine volition flow in everything. That's what the Lord wants from us all. And you need to sort of put some kind of a sign there and put a big NB beside it. That's what he's asking for us all. At that moment, he moved in my interior and told me, my daughter, since the divine will is the only nourishing food that contains all flavors and tastes together. Now, the expression of flavors and tastes, he says, the only thing that genuinely satisfies you, body, soul, mind and spirit. Okay. All tastes that are suitable for the soul finds her favorite food and becomes appeased. Her desire finds its food and it only thinks of pasturing itself slowly, no rush, and it forms without desiring anything else. Her inclination has nothing else towards which to tend because it has found the food that satisfies it. Her will has nothing else to look for, because the soul has left her own will, which formed her torment, and has found the divine will instead, which forms her happiness. She has left her poverty and has found wealth, not human wealth, divine wealth. In sum, all of the interior of the soul finds its food, that is, its crafting, with which it remains so occupied and absorbed as to be unable to move any further. In fact, while finding all contentments in this food and crafting, the soul finds so much to do and to learn and ever new things to enjoy. And from a minor knowledge, she learns major knowledge. And there is always something else to learn. In other words, in the divine will, you are shifted out of your university and into a divine university, out of your human university into a divine one. And of course, Louisa has already said to us that you would learn more in a half an hour or in 10 minutes than you would in years in a university. She passes from small things to great things. From one taste, she moves to other tastes. And there's always something new to taste in this environment of the divine will. Very important statement, all of that. It's wonderful stuff. And so... to put that into a kind of a sentence, you'd say, because I did challenge you in your study groups to take something like that and make a point. OK, so if we're making a point, it is that in the divine will, everything that the human being desires is satisfied. So January the 3rd, 1907, true trust reproduces divine life in the soul. Now notice the word true in front of trust. Continuing in my usual state, I saw Blessed Jesus for just a little, and he told me, my daughter, if one fears much, it is a sign that the soul relies on herself. 1 John 4:18. Because in noticing nothing but weaknesses and miseries within herself, she naturally and justly fears. In other words, if you're concentrating on the cracks, you'll be afraid to do anything. On the other hand, if one fears nothing, it is a sign that she relies on God. There's the bicycle going across the rope on the Niagara Falls, okay? If she fears nothing, it's a sign that she relies on God. Because in relying on God, her miseries and weaknesses are dissolved in God. Look at that. Dissolved. Did you notice? And as she feels invested by the divine being, look at that language. It is no longer she who operates, but God operating within her. So what has she to fear? As Psalm 27, 1, what have you to fear? The Lord is my light and my help. Therefore, true trust reproduces divine life in the soul. I want to give you a few scriptures now. I want to give you 1 Timothy 4:10. 1 Timothy 4:10. 1 Peter 3:5. Ephesians 1:12. Jeremiah 17:7. And Galatians 2:20, I no longer live, Christ lives in me. Now, notice the miseries and the weaknesses dissolved in God. Because of the way we were reared and trained and taught and all the rest of it, and not reared and not trained and not taught, okay, we are inclined to think of our miseries and our weaknesses and our disadvantages and all the rest of it. And if you think of them too much, you actually can't go forward. It just isn't actually possible to go forward. And so the Lord says, look, will you trust me and just throw yourself into the divine arms and forget about the problems? Is that okay? Is everybody comfortable or too hot or anything? Okay. So January the 5th, 1907. I have a VIP on this one. True sanctity consists of receiving anything that may happen to us as a speciality of divine love. Now you're going to love this one, particularly during the week. Okay. So let me repeat this again. This is for operating on during the week. True sanctity consists of receiving anything that may happen to us as a speciality of divine love. There's something happening to me at the moment, and I'm not tempted to see it as a speciality of divine love. Saying, okay, I surrender and all the rest of it, but looking at it as a speciality of divine love. Do you see the challenge? Mm-hmm. Okay. Having read about a soul who had scruples about everything and who feared that everything might be sin, I was thinking to myself, how lax I am. I too would like to think of everything may be sin so as to be more attentive not to offend the Lord. And when Jesus came, he told me, my daughter, this is nonsense. Putting all your attention on these nothings, you know, and it turns you completely into yourself. And the soul remains stuck on the path of sanctity, while true and solid sanctity consists of receiving anything which may happen to her or which she may be doing, be it even the most indifferent thing, as a speciality of divine love. I would think that would transform us rather quickly. But if you pass your test first go, would you let me know? Just as it would be if she found a food enjoyable or disgusting. Now watch this. You're going to get a couple of examples of specialities, okay? A speciality of love in the enjoyment, thinking that it is Jesus that produces that enjoyment in the food and that he loves her to the point of giving her pleasure even in material things. Okay. Number two, Lent is coming. A speciality of love in the disgust, thinking that he loves her so much as to produce that disgust for her in order to make her similar to himself in mortification. giving her himself, a little coin that she can offer to him. Now, there's the divine currency. More and more you're going to hear about the divine currency, that things that cost you a little can be used as divine currency to get souls. Thirdly, a speciality of divine love: if she's humiliated, if she is exalted, if she's healthy, if she's infirm, whether she's poor or rich. A speciality of love: her breathing, her sight, her speech, everything, everything. And just as she must receive everything, everything is a speciality of divine love. She must give everything back to God as a special love of hers. Now, it's one thing to receive it as a speciality of divine love. It's quite another matter to turn around and offer it to him as a speciality of love coming from you with gratitude and all the rest of it. So she must receive the wave of the love of God, and she must give to God the wave of her love. Oh, what a sanctifying bath is this wave of love. It purifies her, it sanctifies her, it makes her advance without her even realizing it. I think that's lovely, isn't it? It is a life more of heaven than of earth. And this is what I want from you. Sin and the thought of sin mustn't even exist for you. Because you see, that belongs to back there. It doesn't belong to now in the divine will, and it most certainly doesn't belong in the future. So that's 1 John 3:2. 1 John 3:2. Those who are truly in union with God do not sin. Okay. So January the 10th, I have a VIP on this one. And it says, the evil of one's own taste. Now, instead of the word taste, would you write beside it? Now, don't knock it out or anything, but write beside it, satisfaction. Your own satisfaction. And put a little stroke, whims. And another little stroke, wants. So instead of taste, the evil of one's own taste, satisfactions, whims and wants. Then you have it. The translator likes the word taste, so he uses it quite frequently. But then, of course, if he's Italian, I'd understand that. As I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little, and he told me, my daughter, the attachment of people to their own satisfactions, whims, preferences, tastes, wants, do you see that where I'm trying to elaborate on it for you, is such that I'm forced to contain my gifts within myself. In fact, instead of becoming attached to the donor, that's himself, they become attached to my gifts, idolatrizing my gifts to the offense of the donor. Let me give you an example of this, because we've had some of this problem. We've had a lot of it in America and some of it in Ireland as well. There have been some famous people in America in the last century who became absolutely famous as healers. Okay. Now, if they presented themselves to everybody as, I am the great healer, 0 out of 100. The gift belongs to the Lord. They were just the people the Lord was actually using. And if they presented themselves as the healers, then it meant that they were using it for their own benefit, for their own glory, their own whatever. And it's exactly the same if a gift of teaching has been given and you present yourself as the great teacher. You've missed the bus, the train, the airplane, everything. You see that you can use the gift wrongly and it can end up no use to you or anybody else. Is that okay? Whereas in the divine will, all the time we realize it is the Lord who's playing the tune. Now, I don't know if you remember the days when we watched Tom and Jerry. You might be too sophisticated or too old or too something, but I'm not. And I've always loved Tom and Jerry as a most perfect parable of the relationship between the clergy and the laity. It's absolutely perfect. Perfect. I remember telling that to a bishop and he looked at me and I said, you don't watch Tom and Jerry, do you? I said, you need to. You'll learn a lot about the church. And anyway, so Tom is pretending to be a great pianist or whatever it is, you know, and he has got this magnificent pianoforte, you know, and he's got the audience out, and the audience are all clapping and everything, and he bows and he takes it all and all the rest of it. Next thing, the lid comes up and Jerry is inside, and Jerry was doing all the... So one person is taking all the glory and the other one's doing all the work. Perfect image of the church. The laity do an awful lot of work that other people take glory for. Do you know what I mean? But that's only a humorous side to it, you know what I mean? But it's to keep our eyes on the donor and what he wants to do and what he wants to accomplish, and to keep ourselves in our native nothingness is absolutely fantastic. That means then that some gift that God has given to you won't actually destroy you. So they become attached to their gifts, idolatrizing my gifts to the offense of the donor. So if they find their own satisfaction, I think is a very good word, they act, or rather they do not, just to satisfy their own wants or whatever it is. In other words, the problem is self-indulgence. Okay. And if there's no satisfaction in it, they don't want to do it. So they're not actually serving God. They're just serving themselves. So one's own taste or satisfaction forms a second life in many people. But miserable ones, they do not know that where there is your own satisfaction present, the divine taste can hardly be there, even in very holy things. Now notice, very holy things. So, in receiving my gifts, graces and favours, the soul must not appropriate them as her own things, making of them a satisfaction for herself. She must keep them as divine gifts, using them in order to love the Lord more and be ready to sacrifice them to that very love. So there's the problem of self-indulgence in holy things. A very simple example of self-indulgence in holy things found frequently in people who are starting out an ordinary spiritual life, now not divine will, and they're getting into a prayer life, and they will pray for hours and hours and hours when they're enjoying the prayer, and when they come into aridity in prayer, they won't say a solitary word. And so they have to be helped by a spiritual director to know that you don't indulge just because you're enjoying it, and you don't pull back just because it's difficult. In actual fact, it's in the times of aridity that you really grow, you know. And so that's just a classic example of how people experience prayer. So I have a VIP on January the 13th, 1907 as well. Jesus wanted to suffer in his humanity in order to redo human nature. So we've heard about Jesus redoing the human nature. Continuing in my usual state, I saw my blessed Jesus flashing by, and he told me, "My daughter, how much I love souls. Listen, human nature was corrupted, humiliated, without hope of glory or of resurgence. And I wanted to suffer all humiliations in my humanity." That's Isaiah 52:14. Isaiah 52:14. "In a special way, I wanted to be stripped, scourged, and let my flesh fall off in shreds under the scourges, almost undoing my humanity in order to redo the humanity of the human race and to make it rise again full of life, of honour and glory to eternal life. What more could I do that I have not done?" So that's the same kind of thinking that you find in the reproaches on Good Friday. What more could I have done for you? Okay. And I often think that on Judgment Day, for the souls who chose to go to hell, that he will show them everything he did that actually paid for their salvation and say, "Was that not enough?" I think that would be a worse judgment than just simply saying, "Depart from me," because they would see what they had actually rejected. So January the 20th, 1907, I also have a VIP on that one. The greatest sanctity is to live in the divine will. Having read the lives of two female saints, one who aspired very much to suffering, and the other who aspired so much to be little. Now, when you consider this is 207, who would be the one who would desire to be so very little? Saint Therese. Who would be the one who would desire very much to suffer? No, he's later. This is 1907. No. She's reading the lives of two female saints. Gemma Galgani. You think of someone in the time before her. This is 1907. So you've got to think of people in the time before her. And there are others, of course, but they're the two I remember. I was thinking in my interior about which of the two would be better to imitate, and unable to make up my mind, I felt as though hampered. So in order to be free and to think only about loving Jesus, I said to myself, I want to aspire to nothing but to love Jesus and to fulfill his holy will perfectly. Well, that was St. Therese's motto. That was actually St. Therese's motto. At that time, the Lord told me in my interior, and it is here that I want you in my will, not anywhere else. Until the grain of wheat is buried in the earth and dies completely. He's quoting John's Gospel, chapter 12, verse 24. John 12:24. Until the grain of wheat is buried in the earth and dies completely, it cannot rise again to new life and multiply itself, giving life to other grains. In the same way, until the soul is buried in my will. Now notice the word buried. That means it's over, done and dusted. To the point of dying completely by dissolving all of herself within me, she cannot rise again to new life through the rising of all the virtues of Christ that contain through sanctity. Now, what you're being told here is that a genuine death to self has got to happen for the divine will to truly triumph in us. A genuine death to self has got to happen. So I want to give you Revelation 7, verses 2 to 4. And, okay, Revelation 7, verses 2 to 4. Therefore, let my will be the seal. That's Revelation 9, 4. Let my will be the seal which seals your interior and exterior. And once my will has risen completely within you, you will find true love. This is the greatest of all the other, this is the greatest of all the other sanctities to which one can aspire. In other words, the 36 volumes are summarized in divine will and divine love. So as we're moving more and more into the divine will, we have to be moving more and more into divine love as well. So I want to give you a few references for that. This is for the love. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 5. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 5. John 13, verses 34 and 35. And 1 John 4, 7. God is love. Okay. Now notice he's asking us to let the movement of our being go into real, genuine death to self so that divine love can be born. Now, all the saints have said that before Louisa. They just didn't know about the divine part of the sanctity. They said that the ego must die for agape love, that's the divine love, to be born in us. Okay. So, January the 21st, 1907, one who always loves Jesus cannot displease him. Look at that. Here you're dealing with the all-powerfulness of love. Finding myself in my usual state, I was saying in my interior, Lord, let it be that I may be all yours, and that I may be always, always with you, and that I may never separate from you. However, while I am with you, do not permit that I may be a goad that embitters you, that I may bother you, that I may displease you, but that I may be a goad that is present in you to sustain you when you are tired or oppressed, that consoles you when you are bothered by other creatures. While I was saying this to Blessed Jesus told me, my daughter, one who is in continuous attitude of loving me is always with me. That's a VIP bit. And this person can never be a goad that gives me bother, but a goad that sustains me, relieves me, and soothes me. In fact, true love has this as its own thing. It renders the beloved content. Besides, one who always loves me can never displease me, because love absorbs the entire person. That's why this spirituality of divine love is it, its perfection. At the most, there might be little things, and the soul herself does not even realize that she may displease me, but love itself takes on the commitment to purify her so that I may always find my delights in her. Now, you know that the church teaches that when you receive Holy Communion correctly and reverently, that the Lord deals with small faults. He does the brushing down. And, he just deals with small things. And so that's not what bothers him. What bothers him is when we set our will against something. We put our will into something, or that we put our self forward. If we're glorifying the self and we put the will. They're the two biggies. They're the two baddies, you know. Beyond that, he doesn't mind. Would you bother, for example, if a child came in from playing outside and they got their dress or their trousers dirty, but they came in and gave you the biggest hug you ever got in your life? Would it bother you? No. Would you worry about the dress or the trousers? No. You would not. You wouldn't even think about it. Well, that's what he's saying as well. That the love takes precedence. Okay. So January the 21st, 1907. One who always loves Jesus cannot displease him. Oh, yeah, we're doing that, aren't we?
Yeah.
Okay. So we go to January the 25th, where Louisa sees chastisements. Okay. I'm going through the most bitter days because of the almost continuous privations of Blessed Jesus. At the most, he makes himself seen in passing and like a flash. And immediately he hides so very deep within my interior that I can't even catch sight of him. And always in silence. Now she must know at this stage that he's chastising. Even we know it. So when I saw him after much struggling, and he was all embittered and oppressed, I said to him, tell me at least, what is it that makes you suffer so much? And he, unwilling, but only to content me, told me, ah, my daughter, you do not know what must happen. I think that is World War I. If I told you, you would break my indignation and I would not do what I have to do. This is why I keep silent. So calm yourself about the way I act with you in this period of time. But courage, it will be so very bitter for you. But do it as an athlete, as a generous one, always living, but as though dead in my will without even crying. Now, in the early volumes, Louisa used to cry easily, and the Lord is asking her to grow up and to take his privation and whatever happens and to take it a bit more on the chin. Having said this, he hid deeper within my interior, leaving me as though petrified without even being able to cry about his privation. She's not allowed to cry now. The poor girl's not allowed to die or cry. Okay. Now, to obey, I write that even before the month of January until now, I do nothing but find myself outside of myself. Notice that. I do nothing but find myself outside. She's out of the body experience most of the time. It may also be a dream, but I seem to see places in desolation, cities deserted, entire streets with the houses closed, with no one walking among them, and dead people. My fright at seeing these things is such as to render me as though dazed. And I would like to imitate my good Jesus by remaining, I too, taciturn and silent. Okay. Why this, I am unable to say, because my light, Jesus, does not tell me anything. I wrote this only to obey. She is moving and getting a little push towards that if she is to be in the divine will, she has to be in agreement with what the divine will is doing. And she's told to imitate Jesus in everything. So if he's silent and taciturn, she says, oh, I must be like that as well. Her will must agree. So February the 20th, 1907. It continues with him always in silence, in passing and like a flash. I spent my days in bitterness and as though dazed. It is as if my whole interior had been struck by a thunderbolt without being able to move either forward or backward. I myself am unable to say what has happened in my interior. I believe it is better to keep silent rather than speak about it. Well, she's learned that. We've got that in the last message, haven't we? Mm-hmm. And then this morning he came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, one who does not respond to my grace, they say correspond, lives like those birds who live in by thievery. In the same way, the soul does nothing but live by thievery. She steals my grace. She lives and does not recognize me, and she even offends me. And then he disappeared like a flash. Now, the reason why he's talking like this is because the divine will is in everybody and in everything. And there is nothing that we can do that the divine will doesn't concur with. I cannot use my eyes at this moment or my voice or anything unless the divine will permits it and concurs with it, okay? And so he's saying that some people who are absolutely against his will are using all his gifts and graces but not acknowledging him whatever, and they don't acknowledge him as the source or anything. So he's saying it's thieving, stealing his stuff. Okay, it's very strong language that, isn't it? Wouldn't be so strong if we didn't know how so many people like that. So March the 2nd, there's nothing that equals suffering willingly. Now, the bit that's important there is the willingly. He's not saying there's nothing that equals suffering. It's the willingly. Continuing in my usual state and having learned that almost the entire town was down with the flu and that in other places people were dying, I was praying our Lord that he would be kind and to spare so many victims and that he would make me suffer to spare them, since nowadays I suffer little or nothing, for he has taken this away from me. While I was saying this, he told me in my interior, my daughter, it was said about me that it was necessary for one man to die to save the whole people. Can you at least tell me the gospel?
It's better for one man to die.
Which gospel? It's only in one gospel.
John.
John chapter 11, verse 50. Caiaphas said it. John 11, 50. It was a truth, but at that time it was not understood. In the same way, in all times, it is necessary that there be one who suffers to spare the others. These are the victim souls. Put that at the side. These are the victim souls. In order to be accepted, one must offer oneself voluntarily. Okay. And you find that St. Therese offered herself voluntarily. Louisa did, Padre Pio did, and all the others. And only for love of God and their neighbour, to suffer himself in order to spare the others. So again, it's the imitation of Christ, the great victim. And the suffering of this one person cannot be equaled by the suffering of all the others put together. Because most people suffer unwillingly, don't they? And so if this person who doesn't need to suffer decides that for the sake of saving others, they would take the other person's punishment, the Lord says that's in a category by itself. You'd agree, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Okay. So. And the suffering of this one cannot be equaled by the suffering of all the others put together. There's no value that matches it. Do you think that the void of your suffering is nothing? Yet it is not a complete void. And if I suspended you completely, where would the peoples end up? Woe, woe, things won't end here. Okay. So as we said many times before, Louisa doesn't seem to look at the fact that the privation is part of the suffering. March the 13th, 1907. Louisa prays to Jesus for her mother that she may not go to purgatory after her death. It continues almost always the same way. At the most, he makes himself seen in silence. In these last days, when he made himself seen, he would caress and kiss me. And since my mother was sick, he made me understand that he would take her. So she's told that the mother is going to die. Her both parents died within a couple of weeks of each other. He made me understand that he would take her. I would say to him, my Lord, you want her and I give her to you as gift before you take her. Now, there's the genius way of responding to the Lord. You want her, but I give her to you before you take her. I do not want to wait until you take her without giving her to you before. But I want you to I want from you the recompense for the gift I give you, giving me as a reward of your taking her straight to paradise, which is very unusual. In one of these volumes, Jesus says that 9 out of 10 people who die, good people who die, go to purgatory. That there's practically no one ready to go directly to heaven. So Louisa is asking something very big. Without letting her touch purgatory, at the cost of making me suffer the purgatory that her mother would have. And blessed Jesus said, my daughter, let me do. In other words, would you let God make the correct decisions? Mm-hmm. Okay. So returning to pray again, I would say, but my sweet love, you will have the heart to see my mother suffer in purgatory. She who suffered so much and who cried so much because of me. It is the weight of gratitude that pushes me. So does she accept, let me do? Not at all. She continues, she perseveres. Who is she like? She's like the woman in Luke 18, verses 1 to 8. She keeps at it and at it and at it until she gets what she wants. It's the weight of gratitude that pushes me, that urges me and gives me strength. As for all the other things, do whatever you want. But in this, no, I won't give up. You will content me and will do what I want. Now, that's a bit courageous, isn't it? And he said, my beloved, do not render yourself too importunate, because we say the woman in Luke 18 was the importunate widow. You are truly untiring, and by being untiring, you force me to content you. You see, you do get it if you keep persevering. However, he would not give me a definite answer. I would return to storm him and would cry like a child, and praying him again, I kept offering what he suffered in his passion, minute by minute, hour by hour, applying it to the soul of my mother, that she might be purged and embellished, and I might obtain my intent. So you're getting a lesson as to how to pray for people you love. But he would add, drying my tears, but my dear beloved one, do not cry. You know that I love you. Can I not content you? See, with the continuous offering of my passion, as you let nothing escape you of what I suffered for your mother, your soul is inside an immense sea, and this sea washes her, embellishes her, enriches her, inundates her with light. Wouldn't you love to hear that about everyone you loved? and to assure you that I will content you when your mother dies, you will be surprised by a fire and will feel burned. Uh-oh. What does that mean? You'll get her purgatory. Yeah. You'll be surprised by a fire. In other words, she needs it. You'll get it. I remained content, but not certain, because he had not yet told me whether he would take her straight to paradise. Okay. So May the 9th, I think we'll do this because it follows on from the other one. At the death in purgatory of Louise's parents. It has been a few months since I wrote, and with great repugnance and only to obey, I begin to write again. Oh, what a weight I feel. Only at the thought that I could say to my beloved Jesus, see how I love you more and how my love grows. Since for love of you alone, I submit myself to this sacrifice, and for as long as it lasts, I can also say that I love you more. Thinking that I can say to my Jesus that I love him more, I feel the strength to make the sacrifice to obey. This is May the 9th, 1907. Now, since I do not remember everything distinctly, I will tell you of the past altogether and confusedly, starting from where I left when I was praying that he would take my mother to paradise. So this follows immediately on what we've read, without her touching purgatory. Then on March the 19th, the day dedicated to St. Joseph, in the morning, while I was in my usual state, my mother passed from this life into the sphere of eternity. And blessed Jesus, allowing me to see her as he was taking her, told me, my daughter, the Creator takes his creature. Okay. At that moment, I felt I was being invested inside and out with a fire so alive that I felt my bowels, my stomach and all the rest burning. So she has the fires of purgatory. And if I would have something, it would convert into fire and I would be forced to bring it up immediately after I'd swallowed it. This fire consumed me, Hebrews 12:29. Our God is a consuming fire. Hebrews 12:29. This fire consumed me and also kept me alive. Oh, how I understood the devouring fire of purgatory, which, while consuming the soul, gives her life. The fire does the office of food, water, death and life. But I was happy in that state. However, since I had only seen that Jesus had taken my mother, but he had not showed me where he had taken her, my happiness was not full. And from my very sufferings, I would draw concern, since those would be the sufferings of my mother if she was in purgatory. And seeing blessed Jesus, who in those days has almost never left me. Now, whenever she's suffering continuously, very deeply like this, he stays. I would cry and say to him, my sweet love, tell me, where did you take her? I am content that you have taken her from us because you must keep her with yourself. But if you do not have her with yourself, this I don't tolerate. And I will cry so much until you content me. She would teach you how to pray, wouldn't she? And he seemed to enjoy my crying. He would embrace me, he would sustain me, he would dry my tears, and he'd say to me, my daughter, do not fear, calm yourself. And once you have calmed yourself, I will let you see her and you will be very pleased. Besides, you can have the certainty that I have contented you from the fire that you feel. But I would continue to cry. She doesn't let up. If she wants to see where her mother is, she wants to see where her mother is, and that's that. So does she trust him? Not really. No, she wants to see the evidence. And I think it's important as well, because this experience gives us the courage to truly believe when we pray for others. Okay. So I would continue to cry, especially when I would see him, since I felt in my interior that something was still lacking to the beatitude of my mother. So much so that the people who surrounded me, who had come because of the death of my mother, in seeing me cry so much, thinking that I was crying because of the death of my mother, were almost scandalized, thinking that I had moved away from the divine will, when more than ever I was swimming in this sphere of the divine will. That's the strange thing about people, is that if they know that you're living a spiritual life, they won't allow you to be human. And it's terribly important to be human in front of them. The great story about St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who's called the uncrowned king of the 12th century and set up so many monasteries, and he was famous all over Europe. One of his brothers entered the monastery with him, and they were very close, very, very close. And then some years later, his brother died. And Bernard cried so much that he scandalized the whole monastery. And they insisted that, crying or no crying, he would give the homily at his brother's death. And he said something like, well, I can't say everything he said. He said something like, "You think because I love God that my love for my brother won't be real." He said, "You think I'm not human. And because you think I'm not human, you're not allowing yourselves to become divine. You're afraid that you'll lose your humanity." He says, "No, you become more human. You become more complete." And he said to them, "In losing my brother," he said, "I've lost more than half of me." He said, "And everything inside of me is grieving." And he gave the most incredible homily for the death of his brother. I think it's beautiful. But the people looking at Louisa have the same problem. If she's in the divine will, surely she should just agree. But you can agree, but you still have your whole relationship with that person, you know, and you have all the history of that your relationship with that person, and you've got all the closeness of the love and everything you've been through and all the rest. If that's not allowed to express itself, it would be very detrimental, and I think it would be very inhuman as well. So that just needs to be said, just in case people misunderstand anyone in the divine will. But Louisa said, "I don't appeal to any human tribunal because it's false, only the divine, which is full of truth. And good Jesus was not condemning me. On the contrary, he would sympathize with me. And in order to sustain me, he would come more often, almost giving me a reason to cry more, because if he would not come, with whom was I to cry to impetrate what I wanted?" See, the people didn't realize that she was interceding for her mother very intensely. The people were right, because they judged from the outside, from a human point of view. But you can see why. Put this down, Matthew 7:1-5. Matthew 7:1-5, that the Lord tells us not to judge. We usually get it wrong. So they judged from the outside. And then, after all, since I'm so very bad, it's no wonder that the others would be scandalized with me. Then after quite a few days, as good Jesus came, he told me, "My daughter, be consoled, for I want to tell you and show you where your mother is." But he didn't do it until she had done the full purgatory. That's incredible, isn't it? Mm-hmm. "Since before and after she passed away, you have suffered continuously that which I earned, did and endured for her good in the course of my life. She partakes in what I did and enjoys my humanity. Only the divinity is concealed from her." Why is that? Because the whole church was only at the level of the humanity, okay? And the revelation of being in the divinity is only being given through Louisa, okay? "Only my divinity is concealed from her, but it will shortly be unveiled to her as well." In other words, she had a very light sojourn in some place that wasn't terrible fire, because Louisa took the fire, okay? But she hadn't yet seen God in his fullness. "And the fire you feel and your prayers have served to exempt her from any other pain of senses, which all must have." Notice the "all." Notice the "must." Okay. I just want you to notice, if you just look at certain words, you really don't need an explanation. "Which all must have, because my justice, receiving satisfaction from you, could not take it from both." Okay. "At that moment, I seemed to see my mother within an immensity which has no boundaries." Okay. That's God's presence. And in it there were many delights and joys, for as many words, thoughts, sighs, works, sufferings, heartbeats, in sum for everything that the most holy humanity of Jesus Christ contained. I understood that it is a second paradise for the blessed. And in order to enter the paradise of the divinity, one must pass through the paradise of the humanity of Christ. Okay. All must pass through the paradise of the humanity of Christ. Therefore, the fact of having touched no other purgatory had been a most singular privilege for my mother, reserved for very few. However, I understood that even though she was not amid torments, but rather amid delights, her happiness was not perfect, but almost halved. Isn't that incredible? Because she hadn't yet moved into the divinity. So we don't seem to grasp just how much purification needs to go on. It's a bit frightening, isn't it? This goes on and on for another couple of pages, so I'm going to stop there because the time is up. Is that okay? And we'll just pick it up when we come back, because there's a lot of thinking to be done on that, isn't there? Mm-hmm.